So this is the fifth day of the seven-day June retreat here in the pristine, what do you call it? The pristine this. How wonderful. For those of you who count, this means we are now in a two-day retreat. Okay? So sometimes when people in a seven-day retreat, they kind of pace themselves, right? But there's no need to pace yourself anymore. If you feel like sprinting, you can sprint. Sometimes, you know, we want to make sure we get a good night's sleep because, you know, all that stuff. But at this point, it really doesn't matter in 2 days whether we get a good night's sleep or not get a good night's sleep, you know, stuff like that becomes less important. So again, these are two wonderful days. I really warn you to be very diligent, again, in not breaking the commitment you made to yourself to stay in the present and not to wander in the future. You don't have to worry. The future will arrive. When it arrives, you know what it'll be called? The present. And then in the present, you can actually enjoy it or experience it. And it will be whatever it will be. All you could possibly do now is fabricate in your mind some kind of imaginary future that is absolutely one-dimensional, does not have live people in it. At the very least, it is a poor cartoon. We have to put aside our cartoon making, and learn to enjoy what is now. Also, you may not realize it, but oftentimes having fantasies, expectations, etc., imaginary creations about the future, you're already contaminating your experience in the future. We don't even know it. We're already conditioning that experience. So when it occurs, in a way it occurs, our capacity just to be totally open and present to it may be distorted because we've already overlaid it with a conception, a perception. Is that clear? And we don't even know that. So there's no need to interpret life. Life is to be what? Lived. And where is life lived? Now. You can't live it anywhere else. When you know that, and you know that the only enjoyment, real enjoyment you'll get in life, is by living it in the present, and we'll give up our these meanderings. For some people it's meandering, some people it's fairly persistent journey. Whatever, again, for many of us, no one taught us, no one showed us how to dwell happily in the present. Nobody even told us about a present. We often grew up where people were always looking forward to things and talking about things and like that. And many of us maybe might have grown up in situations during the course of our childhood and adolescent where the present was not a pleasant place. Could have been, a boring place. You know, like kids go to school, a lot of kids are just bored, right? So, you know, it could have been a boring place, or it could have been things going on that created unhappiness in us. So we somehow learned to be in the present was not good. was not safe, or, you know, lots of things I could say. But more or less, without knowing it, we slipped into this mode of either, you know, always living, fabricating, fantasizing, or else, you know, always going over things, ruminating, thinking about, replaying what just happened or past events, or again, you know, this endless, again, it's a kind of a backwards fantasy. And so therefore our minds are you know what they are. Again, so this needs to be corrected. Again, obviously, on the positive note, learning to be mindful, learning about the present moment, learning to undertake the practices that facilitate us learning to be here is the most important thing. But understanding, not just repeating the words, but really understanding the groundless basis of thoughts of past and future, understanding that doing it is not just benign, it is robbing us of our life. And, you know, we don't have to do it, right? Now again, having said that, it's just like with an alcoholic. When they understand that their addiction is harming them and they make the vow and commitment not to drink again, that doesn't mean that they're never desire it, right? Have an impulse, wanting and needing, you know, all kinds of things. But if the barrier is there, no, don't cross it, there will always be an alarm that will go off at that point, and one will find something else to do. Right, one will bring oneself back. Right, in the same way, these boundaries that we erected, that hopefully we've gotten used to having, even though for some of us it may be kind of uncomfortable, again, they're good to have all the time. Now again, I mean, some people say, well, don't you have to do some planning, or don't you have to, you know, plan for your retirement, or, you know, if you're going to go, yeah, I mean, of course. Right? To practice Dharma doesn't mean we lose our common sense. But if you think about your future planning, that which is deliberate and necessary, right? I mean, you know, deliberate planning, right? When something needs to be planned for is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the other 99% of the stuff. I just want to make that clear. Do everybody understand? It's that just meandering kind of, you know, when you're doing something else. That can be eliminated. And again, and then your actual deliberate planning can be very deliberate, right? And very clear, and it can be done, you know, rather than in this other way. Yes, how I got here. Yes. So therefore. Let us over these next 2 days. Thank you, Harry, for bringing me back. Thank you. Over these next 2 days, let us do our best to continue right up to the end, to just be here. Again, in our meditations, in every evening, you know, we are having different types of meditation instructions. Again, I was very clear last night in saying to you that even though these teachings of Ati Yoga, these teachings that were given to us in the Liberating Everything Naturally, as you meet it, text, as we're learning in this pointing out text, even though these are the pith, and they go right to the heart of things and explain things really clearly, these other kinds of structures are there to support us. So when we get to this place of great ease, right, and clarity, there is some preliminary work that has been done that allows us to do that, right? As you know, these directions are so simple. And perhaps many of you are finding that within the context of the retreat and the teachings and the support, you're able to do them from time to time. But, you know, outside of retreat, they may be more difficult to generate. It doesn't mean they can't, because of course this is the way things are. And this is always right here. So that is not the problem. The problem is we wander off. So again, these other meditative practices we are doing, the practices of mindful breathing, mindfulness of the body, learning to use mindful breathing to introduce space of body and mind, becoming more aware as we move around of the physical space around us, the actual practice of space gazing. These are all practices that support this transformation of the mind. So concentration and mindfulness. But those practices that we undertook last night are also, as I said, key. Because it is our belief, our strongly held belief and identification with the I, with the me, that we are a separate self, is really again the contaminant of all our experience, and it is the fundamental misperception that we are living in, and that must be uprooted. And again, even when one can have an experience of a non-self moment, one can have an experience of the clarity of awareness, in which no trace of self can be found. Self will then again continue to arise because of habit energy. So it is important that this practice of continuing to examine the continuum of our experience to really uproot this false notion of a self. Is that clear? What does this mean? It means that throughout one's day, one can, as one is practicing one's mindfulness and direct awareness, whenever that there's a feeling that there is somebody here doing something, right? So you're eating your food, and there's a sense, I'm eating. It feels like there's somebody eating. Right? There's not just eating, but like I'm eating. Is that clear? That sense of, and at that moment, as you're eating, you can be looking into your mind. Is there really an I, like we did last night, that's eating, or is there just eating? You see, you're separating the misperception of I to the actual experience of what's going on, which is what? Eating. Mm-hmm. That's all that's going on, and yet we have this sense: I am eating. I like this, I don't, So whenever your likes and dislikes, again, just turn it around. What is this I? Where is it found, this I that right now doesn't like this? Right? Is that clear? When you're walking, I am walking. I am walking mindfully. I'm really enjoying this walk. Right? Again, there it is. There's no longer just walking, just pure experience. There seems to be somebody who's attached themselves to the experience, right? Who's kind of come along for the ride and is kind of telling you how it's doing and how you're doing and how everything's going. Again, at that moment, you just turn in your mind and you just look. And right away, that should purify. Immediately, that will purify. The perceiver will be purified at that moment. Is that clear? In the same way, anything. When you have a strong, like we did last night, when you have a strong emotion or a feeling, turn it around. Right? So throughout the day, this inquiry, who or what is saying this, doing this, hearing this, right? You're sitting by the stream, right? And it feels like you're listening. I'm listening, right? Or I'm watching the fireflies. Is there an I? There is an I. But is there an I in the I? That's what it means when we talk about purity. purifying experience. And once you've done that and you feel that there's nothing there, then immediately you are introduced into the spacious non-self quality of your mind. And you just rest there in the experience, whatever it is. Enjoy your meal. So again, meditative inquiry in this way, whether it's, who or what is mind, and inquiring into the nature of your mind, looking into the nature of thoughts, they all lead to the same place. That is the place of emptiness. And when you arrive there, and usually you arrive there because at some point in your inquiry, you're just blocked. There's nothing, you can't find anything. Right? At that moment, just rest. Just rest your mind in that. There's nothing more to do, is there? No. Just rest there. And learn to experience your mind as it really is. Another way to say it, to experience yourself as you really are. Not this little thing over here, that has one letter called I, or me. Not that, but this. It's a different experience. And we want to, at the same time that we're cutting our attachment and our misidentification with this little self, at the same time, we are experiencing, getting more of an experience of who we are, what we are. Is that clear? Yeah, it's kind of simple. So, returning to our story of the old lady. In one sense, there's not much happening, is there? She and the master are just sitting there on the outskirts of Samye. She and her attendant, we don't know who was with Padmasambhava, but we would guess Yeshe Sogyal was with him, because since she wrote this down. He's pointing directly at her heart. And he's instructing her in these, what he's called the master's three words of instruction. Purifying externally perceived objects, purifying the perceiving mind within, and noticing the lucid wakefulness in between. That is delightful. And so, in the previous 2 days, we have listened to the Master's teachings on how the perceived objects outside are purified, and we've listened to him describe to her the means of the inner perceiving mind becoming purified. Is everybody clear about that? Right. The way we purify these flowers is we let them be. We let them be this. We don't even call them flowers if we don't have to. Sometimes we have to. Somebody says, can you pick me up some flowers? So you have to have an understanding that words are pointing to things and they kind of help us. But otherwise, we don't need to run around labeling the world. It just contaminates it. It prevents us actually from seeing what they really are. And what they really are is indescribable. We know writers write endless words, poets write fewer words. But that is never the same as reality. Reality is just this. So again, by not endlessly labeling the world, people experience, by not projecting all our ideas and thoughts and opinions onto everyone in the world, and just by not grasping at things, just let things be. Again, our interpretations, our projections, this is our clinging to. Everything, as soon as it happens, it has happened, right? As soon as the experience has happened, it's happened. As it happens, it is immediately over. But because awareness is ever flowing, there's always something now, right? So there's no, if you cling to something, you are breaking up and interfering with the continuity of unfolding, all-pervasive experience, just unfolding. Isn't that clear? And we don't want to do that anymore. We want to get in the flow. The flow is already here. We just got to stop clinging, grabbing, attaching, interpreting, making stories up. And then we can experience the phenomena of the world in their inherent perfection or purity. Again, the perceiving mind is the mind that sees. Again, we want to purify it of its sense that it is something, that it is something. And just allow the pure perception to occur. We do that the way we have done it here, by looking into directly into the mind and seeing that there is really no such entity or thing called the mind. We are learning to purify the perceiver of this notion that it is a separate self, that it's a me, that it's a Fred, that it's a Harry, that it's an Angie, right? In that way, in the inner world of the mind, there again is no fabrication of conceptuality, conceptions, and there is no grabbing onto them. There is great freedom. We just let things come and go. We let thoughts come and go. We let feelings come and go. When they arise in awareness. There's nothing we need to do. If we let them be, they will go. There's nothing we need to do. The snake will unravel by itself. If you grab it, you're in trouble. So now, the master continues to the third point. As the lucid wakefulness between is delightful, here is the instruction for recognizing your own nature. Okay, so imagine that Padmasambhava is pointing right to your heart. So remember, we talked about in the dualistic way of looking at things and what he's describing here, there are three things, right? There is the object that is perceived, there is a so-called perceiver, whatever that is, And then there is just the act of perceiving. Is that clear? So there is something now that I am I am seeing these, and again, forgive me for using words, but just to explain it. So the object are the flowers, right? This is the perceiver, and in this case, seeing is the perceiving. Is that that's the in between? Remember, he said in between, right? So in other words, if I was dead, right, and if you had me propped up here and I was mummified or something, right? Can you see the object and the perceived perceiver would still be here, right? But there would be no real perceiving. Why? Because there's no consciousness, there's no awareness. Is that clear? So that is the third ingredient. So that's all experience. That's what we're doing all the time, right? So that's the three. We've already purified the two, right? We've purified those, and we've purified this. What's left is what he's calling that which is in between. Okay? As the lucid wakefulness between is delightful, here is an instruction in recognizing your own nature. While practicing free from unknowing, right? What is unknowing? Not knowing the way things really are. That's the way we usually do it. Right? We think those are flowers. We think Fred's really looking at them, and every thought and projection he has about flowers is really what's the truth. Right? That's the world of unknowing. Okay. When we are free of unknowing, our own consciousness, your own consciousness, is clear, pure, and awake. Is that clear? Is it so simple? Okay. So for now, you be the perceiver. Okay. We'll play like a game. You're the perceiver. I'm the object. Right. Okay. Is everybody in the game? Okay. You're the perceiver. I'm the object. Okay. So in looking at this, don't call this Fred. Don't call it a man. Don't call it anything at all. Free yourself in this moment, right, of any idea or conceptualization about this. And just see this just as it is, just as it appears to you. Okay? Secondly, in terms of that which is looking out, don't have any thought that I am looking. There's an I that is seen. I here means a small I, or anything at all. Okay? Have no thoughts, no ideas about yourself or your mind, you know, okay? So what is left? What is left? Just looking, in this case, awareness, right? Okay. And what I want you to do is, whether you call it awareness, whether you call it just looking, notice what that is like. Just that. And the master says, it is clear. Clear means there's no static, right? Clear. Can you see your awareness is clear? It is pure. Again, you've purified it of all those contaminations of subject and object and this and that. And it is awake. It is wakeful. Can you see you're very alert? You're wakeful. How is it? A lot of drama? No. Is there anything missing? No. Is everything okay? Yeah. Do you know what's going on? No. We don't have a clue to what's going on. But yet it's okay, isn't it, not having a clue? Because this is fine, isn't it? I don't have to give it a story, do I? Do you have to give it a story? Oh, I'm here listening to a Dharma talk. See, some people that feels... You see, when we do that, that puts us back in the story, right? Oh, now I feel safe. I'm back in the story. Right, as if our life is a story that we're constantly narrating. So this is stepping out of the story and just be. In this moment, right, there is just wakefulness. He calls it lucid wakefulness, right? It's just very clear. And he says it's delightful. Why is it delightful? It's free and it's fresh. If you think about, whatever delightful means, when you experience something and then you say, oh, this is really delightful, right? If anybody has ever an experience of, this is delightful, what is that experience like? That all of a sudden we say, this is really delightful. Anybody ever have a delightful experience? Yeah, there's a freedom. It's something that's delightful is usually spontaneous. Unexpected, right? This is really delightful. You know? Did you know how we say that? It's a kind of, not a surprise, but a real kind of enjoyment. This is really delightful. Almost like we didn't think it would be. Get it? We didn't think it would be. So that delightful is that element of spontaneous surprise, how things are unfolding. Now, what if you were like this all the time? Anybody getting scared? Good. Good. Like I said yesterday, right? It's again, as we practice and these things come up and the fear and the resistance comes up, that's fine. Just look at it, right? You know, go. You should always be, you know, don't run away from it. Don't deny it. Don't repress it. Go, oh, that's interesting, right? You know, why is that? That's something that sounds okay. Why is my first response to pull back, right? So that's, again, interesting. So he says, while practicing free from unknowing, your own consciousness is clear, pure, and awake. That's what this is. When practicing, you have the experience that your innate, self-existing wakefulness is neither spoiled by a conceptual attitude nor by clinging to any mind state. So this, when you are just resting in this innate wakefulness, right, mind free of any concept of perceiver and object, right? This is not something that you, this wakefulness is not something that you have manufactured, have you? You haven't made it happen. All you've done is notice what's already here. That is why it is said it is innate. You don't have to do anything. For those of you who thought, I really got to work to create this mind state, right? I got to really work hard to kind of clarify my mind, right? No, your mind already is clear. Again, like we said yesterday, it's just the mirror is covered with dust. Clear away the dust. How is it? Clear. It is innate. He calls it self-existing wakefulness. It exists unto itself, this wakefulness. It is not created or manufactured at all. Right? So when we are practicing mindfulness, many people think, oh, I am developing this thing called mindfulness, right? There may be many people in this room who think, oh, I'm just, you know, I found this great practice called mindfulness and I'm really developing it. No. Mindfulness is just noticing what's already here. Right? When you are, let's say you're mindful of eating, your awareness is already aware that you're reading. You're just kind of getting a quote out of your head and noticing what's already happening, right? When you look at me, you're not having to create a scene, are you? No. The scene is effortless. It's innate. There's nothing that needs to be done. So self-existing wakefulness is neither spoiled by conceptual attitude nor by any clinging. What does that mean when it's not? It means it's not spoiled. It means, in the same way, if you look at the sky, right, and a bird flies through it, are a flock of birds, for those of you who have many thoughts. Let's say a big flock of birds. Right. Thousands of birds fly across the sky. Is the sky spoiled in any way? Right. In any way is the sky spoiled? Contaminated? No. As soon as the birds fly through, it's exactly the same, isn't it? Is that right? Right. These clouds that cover the sky today, when they're gone, will the blue sky still be there? Yeah, is it there right now? Yeah. It's not disturbed in any way. This self-existing wakefulness is neither spoiled by conceptual attitude nor by any clinging. Is that clear? This mind cannot be destroyed. It cannot be contaminated in any way. All the spoiling and contamination is going on in our fabricated mind and the emotional that it is. That's the clouds, you see. That's all it is. In no way is our essential mind ever been in any way changed at all. That is why, for those of you who say, oh, but I've had a rough life, and God, if you know what I've been through and things I've done, or if you know what kind of mind I have, God, you know what I mean? Yeah, that could be okay. That's your narrative of what's happened. But your essential mind is still the same. It's always available to you. It's available always. For waking up to. Therefore, he says, as that itself, the self-existing wakefulness, this is your Buddha mind. And when you know that, you have recognized your own nature. So as you sit, looking at this, don't even call it an object, mind empty of any thought or conception, and just seeing, purely seeing, in that moment, in this moment, what you're experiencing is your own true mind. We call that our Buddha mind. Because not only does it have this quality of lucid wakefulness and awareness, it also has this incredible capacity of knowing. There's a knowingness in this mind. It just knows. It knows. It is not inert. It is not dead. It is vivid and alive. It can be trusted. That is why we chant in the morning, what? Trust in mind. Capital M. Most of us have lived our life trusting our mind little m. What seems truer? What seems realer? Which is more delightful? It is like the example of not needing to imagine your mother to be your mother, as you have no fear due to thinking that she is not your mother. Now, this obviously implies that when you think about your mother, it's a very intimate, close thing, right? But we're saying, in the best of circumstances, the child and the mother are inseparable, you know, and the child always knows that the mother is there, right? Always knows the mother, never feels separate from the mother, and always knows that the mother is there, right? So in that case, the child never thinks, gee, do I have a mother, right? It is like the example of not needing to imagine your mother to be your mother, as you have no fear due to thinking that she's not your mother. It would never even dawn on you that your mother was not your mother, right? It's like that. Similarly, when your awareness recognizes that it is the innate nature of dharmata, the essential truth of things, you will no longer mistakenly imagine that the phenomena of samsara, that's all the phenomena that we think is always coming and going, you will no longer mistakenly imagine that the phenomena of samsara is your innate nature. At this point, we identify with what? What do we identify with?
Our story.
Whether it's the story of the self and the story of everything that's going on. That is samsara, the world that we have fabricated out of thought. Right? We think that is who we are. Whether it's a story about Fred, or whether it's a story about everybody else in Fred's life, or the story of the world, this is what we believe is our innate nature. What he's saying is, this is who we think we are. We don't think that we're just this, which has no story. Once you recognize that the innate nature, your written innate nature, you'll no longer mistakenly imagine that the phenomena of samsara are your innate nature. And then he goes on to say, of course, even without knowing that, you were never separate from your true nature, your true mind. I mean, have I lost you? Yes.
I'm missing something here. I don't think I ever thought that my nature was phenomenal.
Well, if I said to you during the course of your many years, Lee, of life, the comings and goings of life's experiences, your thoughts, your feelings, your perceptions, the people, the experiences, have you not always identified them? And when they're going well, you've been happy, and when they haven't gone well, you've been sad, and haven't you always tried in your own nice way to control and manipulate life to make it go your way? That's what he's mean. That's what we've always identified as us or life. I mean, these are just words. As opposed to going, oh, this is who I am. It doesn't have to be manufactured. Just any questions, really? I mean, don't hold back. This is deep, in a certain way. Yes.
And samsara also includes my term
worldview? Yeah, all that. Right. All the views of the world, all the comings and goings of life, you know, the ups and downs, the backs and forth. That's, in Buddhism, that's called samsara, the world of change, the world of, you know, things are endlessly changing, and, you know, we've always identified with that. And therefore, that's why we get spun around a lot, right? Because it's always spinning. When we identify with this, there's no spinning. Everything is just as it is. Anyhow. So then he says, kind of referring to what he's already presented, as this is known as the unfabricated training. Okay? So as you see, as opposed to most ever, for those of you who have gotten lots of Buddhist teachings or some Buddhist teachings or gone in other types of retreats and all that, we know that we get lots of what? Things to do. Practices to do. Here there's no practice to do. It's called, that's why it's often called, this is the meditation of non-meditation. Because we're just what? We're just totally natural. This is just our own true mind. And we are getting all the fabrication out. There's nothing to do, is there? Other than just rest in this. And just let things come and go. Anybody panicking at that one? What? Just let things come and go. Not to try to control and manipulate the situations and everybody around me to make them the way I want. What? This is a different way. Again, it doesn't mean you don't respond to situations and deal with situations, but it comes from a sense of understanding. So we know in this way that everything is devoid of their own self nature, everything is what it is. And you know your own nature by yourself. Finally, we know who we really are. Up to now, we have all these ideas about who we are. And they change. But this is having no idea who you are. You don't need an idea to be you. It's the stupidest thing, isn't it? I mean, do the birds need an idea of themselves to be a bird? Do they? No. Right? I mean, what in nature needs an idea, a thought about, of themselves to be who they are? Nothing. Well, we don't need it either. We are who we are. We don't need to make up a story about who we are. Right? So you run into people and, you know, everybody just tells their story. Well, who are you? And they tell, well, I was born here and did this and did this and did this and then this happened, that happened. Right? But like, well, who are you? Like the one sitting right here. I want to know you. Right? How do you know somebody? By their story? No, by in the moment being open with another human being. Right? Isn't that how we know each other? I mean, how do we know? I mean, if I had read books and books and books on flowers, would I really know what a flower is? I would think I did, wouldn't I? If all I've ever done is read books about flowers, I might walk in here and walk right by these things. Oh, I never knew that was what a flower was. I mean, isn't, let me look at my book here, isn't it? Hmm? When you have recognized this, there is neither superior nor inferior birth, neither higher nor lower activities, neither sharper nor weaker intellect, neither greater nor lesser intelligence, neither vast nor narrow learning, neither high or nor low age, neither clear or unclear mind. Is that clear? I mean, this is the liberation. This is the place where all things come together. This is why here we are, right? We're people of different ages and people of different ethnicity and different backgrounds, different sex, different gender, right? All kinds of things, right? Different. And yet, we meet in this sameness. Because here, all those differences have no meaning at all, do they? Right? Some people may have postdoc PhDs. Some people might have dropped out in high school. It doesn't matter. Does it? No. When we sit here in this awareness, totally fresh and present, whether we had a wonderful childhood or a terrible childhood, does it matter? No. This is uncontaminated by any of that. Is that clear? But if you carry that story about who you were and who you are and what your childhood was and what, and if that is something you carry with you all the time, it will be you. That's what it means to where we identify our nature with our story. Yes.
So doesn't that mean that if all of us here are actually in our central nature?
No, we are.
Okay.
Okay, let's just, this is not a...
If the self, if we were not identified with the self, there really is nothing to know because
we're
not
even know. Yeah, and you will hear in Buddhism just that, you know, there's nothing to know. Just like there'll be phrases in Zen, you know, there's nothing to attain. It's already here. We're attaining what we already have.
Right?
Yeah. If we're willing to come out from where we're hiding, come out, wherever you are. Yeah? When we meet in this place, yeah, there is a knowing. So then the master says, this is an instruction of little hardship, but simple to grasp. Easy to apply, but very effective. With which you will have no dread at the time of death. Remember, she said to him, you know, I don't know if she's dying, but she's old enough to know that, you know, she will be dying soon. When you understand that that's the truth, with an old, tottering old lady, or man, that is apparent. Many of us who are not at that enfeebled, tottering stage, we think it's still far away, but we don't know. None of us know. Right? Even young people die. They die of fairly certain kinds of diseases. They die in car and motorcycle accidents. They die of, right? So we don't know. When we're comfortable in our house and everything is nice and easy, we're not in a hurry, are we? We're very relaxed. But all of a sudden, if we smell smoke, and if we know the house is on fire, we have only one thought. What's the quickest way out, right? We're not going to finish our TV program. We're not going to finish our meal. That's not our concern, is it? So in the same way, when we understand the impermanence of our life, we understand that we cannot dally as if we have forever. As I said to you earlier, there are half a dozen members of our community, very sincere practitioners, who very much are looking forward to coming here, being with us. And right up to a couple of weeks ago, their plans were already made to come. Right? Travel plans made, flights booked. And then impermanence. We never really know what's going to happen. So if we have this opportunity now, we should not waste it. So he says, this is an instruction of little hardship, but simple to grasp, easy to apply, but very effective, with which you will have no dread at the time of death. Though those of you who feel that you do when you think about your death or others' death, dread, fear, anxiety come up, please understand what he's saying. Old lady, he's looking right at her, practice it. Be diligent, as life does not wait. You get no reward from slaving for a husband and child. Kind of subversive in his day, wasn't it? Don't know if her husband was listening in, but you get no reward from slaving for a husband and child. So do not return empty-handed, but take along the provisions of your master's instructions. So when he says, do not return empty-handed, you know, she's come to the monastery for whatever reason, and she's obviously going to return home. So he says, do not return empty-handed, but take along the provisions of your master's instructions. These are the most important provisions that we can carry with us. We should always remember when we pack our bag not to forget the provisions of the teachings we have received. They are the most important. And then he says, the tasks of this life are endless. Does everybody understand that? There is no end to to-do lists. There's no end to things to fix. There's no end to things to do. There's no end to it, is there? Has anybody ever reached the end? No. There's always more. The task of this life is endless. So reach perfection in meditation practice. Old lady, keep this advice as your escort for being fearless at the time of death. And those were his final words to her. And it said, and this is must be Yeshe Sogyal writing, she says, thus he spoke. Since the master gave this instruction while pointing his finger at the old woman's heart, it is known as, quote unquote, the pointing out instruction to the old lady. Pointing out in Dzogchen has a very specific meaning, as you can see in this text, because he pointed out directly the nature of her mind, the nature of reality. Right? It wasn't philosophical or conceptual or psychological. He pointed right at her and said, you know, this is your mind. These are perceived objects. This is this. This is that. This is your lucid wakefulness. Do you experience it? And because it was a pointing out instruction, because it wasn't just a conceptual presentation, but a very living presentation in which he actually had the experience, it is said, upon hearing it, the old lady and her attendant were both liberated and attained accomplishment right then and there. Right? just by receiving the pointing-out instructions of our teacher, when we are introduced to the true nature of things, the true nature of our mind, immediately, in that moment, there is the capacity for liberation. So it is said Lady Sogyal of Karchan, that's where she was from, committed it to writing for the benefit of future generations. It was written down on the southern slope of Samye on the 17th day of the second summer month in the year of the hare. And then there's a little final verse. This is a term of treasure. We don't need to go into that. It says, concealed as term of treasure for the sake of future generations. May it meet with a worthy emanation. May it instruct beings in an appropriate way. Through this, may the destined ones liberate their stream of being. Right. So here we are. Right. 2014, June, Southern Dharma. Right. And this teaching given to an old woman. A 1,000 years ago or more, right, is instructing us. How marvelous, eh? How marvelous. And it was concealed with the hope that when it was revealed at some future time, that this would, that those who hear it would liberate their stream of being. Now that is us. And so that is the text of the pointing out instruction to the old lady given to you with commentary. The purpose of commentary is to help us clearly understand what is being taught in the original text, and as well a good commentary, most importantly, shows us how to practice it, how it really is. It doesn't just explain things intellectually, it shows us how to practice. So we have wonderful teachings to practice. We'll stop here.